Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're about to have a conversation with the mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. Before we do that, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. It's a credit union, not just a bank, so it belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. For more information, www.mecu.com. Or you can go to our website, steinershow.org, and click on their banner on site. We are here joined by Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, our mayor. Welcome, Madam Mayor. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
We are today being Real News is in the house. They're shooting our conversation with the mayor today. It will be on the web on their spot, ours as well. So Megan Sherman from Real News is here with us. And you can be with us, too, at 410-319-8888. Calls are coming in now. We'll take those calls. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. We have a ton of questions here on the Mark Steiner Show, Mark Steiner Facebook page, and coming in now at the Mark Steiner Show page. So either page, jump on and ask your questions. And let's start with an easy one. What's going to happen in the special session when it comes to the city? Between what's been reported in the press that you and County Executive Rushon Baker pushing for the gambling bill to go to referendum, and also just the other issues facing that legislature and how it affects Baltimore.
At the end of the day, I'm convinced that the legislature will reconvene and resolve the budget issues. There's too much at stake for too many jurisdictions. So I'm confident that that will happen. I'm hopeful that we will be able to get table games on the ballot for November, because I think it will help our location, our slots facility. I think it'll bring in more revenue, and it'll give us an opportunity to take advantage of the revenue that's going to West Virginia, it's going to Pennsylvania, it's going to other jurisdictions, and we could take advantage of that.
Three things about that, and we'll move on to something else about the gambling issues. One is that when this all came up, we've been having debates on this program since the 90s on gambling. Your father was part of them when he was in the House of Delegates. And there, everybody said, "No, we'll never have gaming tables." I said, "No, we don't want gaming tables. We just want to have slots. We're going to have slots. We'll never have gaming." But most people thought gambling was coming. How could you avoid gaming? I mean, there's a sense of people. Do you think that's part of what causes people not to trust what people say in government when they go, "Oh, no, we're not going to do gaming"? But all of a sudden, gaming is on the table. No pun intended.
Yeah, I've been consistent. I've never equivocated about my support for table games.
So, but I mean, what I'm saying in general, what do you think that says when people hear that, oh, no, that's not going to be what we're going to do, but then that's what ends up happening?
Well, I mean, in order to answer that question, I have to acknowledge that what you're saying is accurate about those statements. I don't know what politicians you're talking about specifically that said, you know, table games never.
Well, I can name a lot from them.
You can, but I don't have a recollection of that.
Okay.
So I have a recollection of my communications about gaming, and I've been supportive of table games for years.
So what do you think – where does a society like ours go?
I thought you said we were starting with an easy one.
That was easy.
That was
– I'm
teasing.
I know. What happens to any society, whether it's Baltimore City, the state of Maryland, when – the revenues we rely on are based on gambling, and I am not a prude about gambling. I could care one way or the less whether people gamble or not, but not based on the responsibility of corporations paying their fair share, of people paying taxes, of how we put money into the coffers that come from us as opposed to gambling. What happens when we start relying on that as our way of living?
We are relying on a diverse revenue stream, and everything that you mentioned is part of it. Business taxes, personal taxes, fees, all of those things we rely on. And if we're smart, we'll figure out a way to get the most out of gaming revenue as well.
So,
I mean, just to, you know, you, for someone who says they don't care one way or the other, mm-hmm. the money is being spent. You know, Marylanders in particular, if you go to the jurisdictions outside of Maryland, you'll see the parking lots are filled with Maryland, with cars with Maryland license tags. So the money is being spent. It's just not benefiting any of us.
Of course, you have people like David Cordish, who's offices here in Baltimore. He's mm-hmm. opening the Arundel County Gambling Center, mm-hmm. who opposes this, obviously.
I'm not sure where he is today.
because it's going to take money out of his pockets.
Potentially, yes.
So, go on to something else. So, tell me what do you expect the city to get out of this session?
We're looking to close a gap on some of our public safety funding. I'm certainly hoping the school funding gets us to where we anticipated. I think we were down about $22 million in anticipated school funding. So, we're hoping that those gaps will be closed.
And if we have to pay for a portion of the teachers' pensions, how will that affect us?
I think, I'm not looking forward to it for a number of reasons, but I am pretty sure that the legislature is trying to mitigate the early years, mitigate the damage of, us taking on the teacher pensions in the early years. But I think, I certainly think it could be made better.
So one of the things that came up in the state legislature was, and I want to ask you this question since it came up.
Mm-hmm.
You and Dr. Alonzo had very different ideas about how to pay for school construction.
I wouldn't say very different.
Well, let me just throw this out and see. Maybe not, maybe yes, we'll find out. I mean, that we had opportunity through the 6320 Corporation to use leverage the state money, leverage our money in the city that we put into the school system to get $1.2 billion in a bond that would have come to the city immediately to start construction on schools like they've done in other cities, like in Greenville, South Carolina, which created a boom in the economy, a boom in construction, inner-city residents getting jobs, kids seeing the schools being built. But, it wasn't pushed very hard than Dr. Alonzo, it seems, and maybe you can correct that, and I thought you were opposed to that.
So I was very supportive of Dr. Alonzo's plans. I worked the bill, all of the school construction bills with Dr. Alonzo, with the leadership in the legislature, so I don't know what would give you that impression.
I guess it was some of that we couldn't afford to take on that debt.
We may have had a difference of opinion about the raising the school's debt limit, but that aside, I was certainly. I certainly advocated for, number one, a freer use of our capital fund so we could do more projects with the money that we do have. And I was supportive. I sat in, legislators' offices in leadership with Dr. Alonzo advocating for us to be able to leverage the funds.
So why do you think it didn't happen? What things stopped us from getting that bond that would have kind of helped?
It's all my fault.
I'm not putting the land on your doorstep. I'm asking, why do you think it happened? Why do you think that we couldn't move the state legislature
It was a novel idea, and you know as well as anybody, there's very little that gets introduced as a new idea, a new way of doing business, and gets passed in one session. That's just not the way the legislature works. You have to massage the issue. We went down there. We fought really hard, and I'm looking forward to going back next year.
Wait, what are you going to do during the special session? What will your presence be there then, and what will you be fighting for during this one or two special sessions we may have? It's unclear.
Yeah, I'll certainly be fighting for the anticipated revenue. Again, we have some public safety revenue that we're looking for. Again, the school money that we're looking forward to. That we were anticipating getting. Those are the main things that I'll be fighting for.
We have a lot of folks calling in at 410-319-8888. We're going to cover lots of topics here, as many as we can, with our mayor, who joins us once again here in the studio. We'll be looking at issues concerning the West Side developments coming up, the issues between the Orthodox Jewish community and Black community around the trial that's going on now that we've talked about yesterday in the air, trying to bridge that gap. Gambling we've talked about. We will look at West Side Development and more. Your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones and get one of our first callers in. And Casey in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
Very well, Casey. Welcome.
Hey, how are you, Mayor?
Great, thank you.
Good. I haven't necessarily been one of the mayor's biggest advocates in
that's
the city.
That's saying it mildly. you're funny.
But I will say this. I think there has been marked improvement and marked differences, so I do take my hat off to that. But as you sit up there at Morgan State University, I think the major concern that I have at this point would be what we're going to be doing with the kids with some of the closings of the rec centers. I mean, you're sitting up at Morgan. We have a great resource up at Morgan called EDAC, the Entrepreneur Development and Academic Center. I think we need to start growing our children to be entrepreneurs and to build our workforce. And if there's some way that, you know, to take something from you to build, bridge the gap with the children, education, and finding something for them to do to perpetuate growth in their lives and in the city workforce, I think we need to start looking on that. What are we doing to address that?
I definitely think that entrepreneurship is part of the equation. I've been a big supporter of Nifty. I've had them down at City Hall hosting Nifty fairs where the different entrepreneurs that participate in Nifty get to come and show their projects, talk about their business plans, and sell things. And I've given them a venue to do that at City Hall. And I'm certainly looking forward to getting some information about the program that you talked about, Casey, because in order for us to have a strong workforce, we do need to do the things like I'm doing, you know, fighting hard to get kids summer employment with Youth Works. I've been advocating with companies all over the city for our Hire One Youth Initiative. That's where we're fighting for the little bit older kids, 16 to 21, that have some work experience to get them some private sector, diverse private sector job opportunities. And the business community has been quite receptive. We've been able to identify and a lot of different industries that are helpful, the banking industry, even radio stations have come on board, media has come on board wanting to take, give some of our young people some opportunities. So it's a compliment. It's, you know, working hard with you know, organizations that promote entrepreneurship, working together, working with Youth Works to promote the programs for opportunities for young people to work over this summer, because we know that leads to careers and it opens up doors that young people might not even know that certain careers exist, but for the fact that they had this experience over the summer. So I'm working really hard for that. And we are working hard, and we'll be revealing soon, or unveiling soon, our Super Summer program that's going to talk about how we're all of the different programs and opportunities that we are working in coordination with all of our partners, the Family League, the school system, Enoch Pratt Free Library, to offer full-day enrichment for young people all over the city.
How many jobs do you expect will be there for kids this summer?
We know more than 5,000, but I'm not sure what the total number will be.
Let me go back to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Tanya, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm actually calling to congratulate the mayor. I feel that she's done a great job showing her respect and support to all the minority groups of Baltimore City. Her actions have made it known to Baltimore that all people are treated equally. And she's appointed commissioners where people can go, and they know that they have somewhere to get their questions answered. And I appreciate that, you know, especially for the Hispanic community. It's been a tremendous help to the community to know that they have somewhere to go to get the help that they need. And she's really tried her best to unite the communities and bring them together.
Thank you very much, Tanya, for the call.
Thank you so much. Thank you. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to, I can't see. Show me the names on 2 and 4. We'll get those folks who have been holding on a while, but I can't see the names are not popping up on the screen. Just send me the names and I'll get to those calls. So let's go to Tyrone. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. How you doing, Mark?
Very well. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, man. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Great. I'm calling. So I just heard you. I'm grateful to hear that you are definitely, you know, planning to do good things for youth in Baltimore City because it's needed. My question is just kind of two questions quick. And first is, Mark asked you about the number of youth jobs that was going to be available this summer. You said 5,000. In the city council, a bill was passed for doubling youth jobs this summer. As you stated on your campaign trail, that was something that you would do. So I wanted to know, one, would you actually amend the budget to put in money to double youth jobs? Because this would actually help youth, as well as doubling funds for after-school program, which was another bill that was passed unanimously by the council. And also, I would like to know, what's your position on the youth jail?
So I'll go in reverse. I think I'm not 100% sure where the youth jail stands at this point. I know that was something that the state was reevaluating, the actual need for it. I think we have to do both things. We have to have programs, hopefully diversion programs, so kids don't get into to problems. We have to have supervision for kids that get into problems that are able to be in the community. And we also need to have places for young people who cannot be in the community because they're either a danger to themselves or to others. So my hope is when we have those facilities that they'll be quality and they'll offer the young people the services that they need. That being said, I'm not 100% up to date on where the state is on that youth jail. With respect to youth jobs, I said at a minimum 5,000 jobs. We're working very hard to get more. And what I said specifically on the campaign trail is I wanted to work with other stakeholders, other partners, to help us identify resources. I think it is remarkable to have a resolution without a solution. You know, to say that we should double youth jobs without saying where the money's going to come from, you know, I think it is, I don't want to call it pandering, but it's like right next to that. Because, you know, I think it's very easy to say, you know, we should double youth jobs, we should, you know, double recreation centers. It's easy if you don't have to find the money for it. But what I asked for when I campaigned was the help from organizations who were advocating for double youth jobs and more recreational programs. Help me, you know, that I'm here, I'm knocking on doors, I'm making calls, trying to raise money, because we are, as across the country, dealing with the Great Recession, the new normal. So we don't have the resources that we once had. So, you know, partner with me. You know, don't just state the obvious that we need more opportunities. Roll your sleeves up and let's raise some money to get there. Let's look for some new partners. I'm certainly doing it, and I'm hoping to have, you know, not just people who want to identify what the problems are, but people who want to actually get on the phone, want to make the calls, want to reach out and try to help raise money so we can have these opportunities.
So when we talk about money for the city, and folks, we're going to get your calls, 410-319-8888. We have Hank and Adam, or is it Adam and Hank? One of those, One Direction. We'll come to your call here in just a second. We're going to throw a question out here, then we'll come back to your calls and go to our Facebook page. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we talk with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. When we talk about money, one of the things was in the news today, it's been in the news for the last several days, has to do with Lexington Square Partners and the development of the West Side around Howard Street. And this whole question about tax breaks in the city and TIFs. There are a lot of people, first of all, talk about why these developers should get these TIFs. What's the argument for them getting TIFs and payment in lieu of taxes? For developing downtown, let's start with stuff there.
Well, it's not just downtown, and that's the thing that really burns me up when people want to talk about TIFs and pilots. They talk about just downtown. I mean, you look at Mondawmin Mall. That was, you know, tax incentives, and that's provided a tremendous anchor for that community. You know, we have the first Target in the city. You know, my Marshalls, my favorite Marshalls. Well, it's not the only Marshalls in the city, but, you know, it's the one that I enjoy. And it's provided thousands of jobs for people in the community. So, you know, we have Mondawmin Mall, we have Belvedere Square. We have things that are outside of downtown that provide anchors and help us build communities. So, you know, we have several projects in the city that in order for them to go forward, you know, you do the but-for test, we need to create some incentives. And when the upside of those incentives are, we get taxes in the future. We also get an opportunity to create jobs and to strengthen our neighborhoods. We're working really hard to transform the West Side. And if it means that we need to create incentives to spur development so we can get the type of amenities that we need to complement what's already there, I think it would be irresponsible not to look to create a win-win situation so we can get these properties moving. I have a great partnership with Dr. Perman from University of Maryland at Baltimore, and we're working hard. And if you've been down there, you've already seen the evidence of our partnership. We've got a great public safety partnership. We've brought in social workers and drug treatment workers that are helping us with individuals that are suffering with addiction that are in that community. You know, we have economic development plan which we're working on, and you know, it is you know, people are seeing a difference in the West Side. We just had the ribbon cutting for the new and improved light rail stations, and we took the arches down. You know, people are seeing movement in the West Side for the first time in years, and we're going to keep it going.
But let me throw a couple things out about that. I mean, some people look at what happened here years back when the Hyatt was built, the most successful hotel in Baltimore in terms of number of rooms booked all the time. They're still not paying any taxes on either the garage or the hotel, making a ton of money in the city. And sometimes it feels as if, to many people, that we're giving away the store in order to get something from it, to get jobs or taxes in the future. Somebody estimated, though nobody really knows, that the West Side could mean over 20 years, $30 million, $35 million or more that the city doesn't get in revenues.
But this is the thing. You say that, but then what's the alternative? What do we have there now? What is the value of it now? So to say that we're missing out on that is really this whole fantasy. You know, I think when you talk about, you know, when people talk about what the city is missing out on, you're missing the point. We are increasing the value. We're creating jobs. We're strengthening our economy by creating these projects. Otherwise, we can sit around and pontificate about whether or not we should be creating incentives. Businesses, cities that want development, create incentives to bring development and businesses to their cities. Cities that want to, you know, have these theoretical discussions about whether or not you should have, you know, incentives are the ones that don't have anything going on. And I'm not going to be a city that has, I'm not going to be a mayor that has tools in her toolbox to create jobs, to strengthen neighborhoods, to spur development and sit on them because someone wants to have a debate about, you know, what's it worth 30 years from now. You know, this project, this real project, as opposed to some fantasy project that's going to come out of nowhere and create taxes.
I understand what you're saying. And I think just to throw back, I mean, cause I think that there are people who would say, look, that may be true. But what do we know about the people who put up Lexington Square Partners in Atlanta, New York? That what do we know enough about those corporations enough to say they can't afford to do this without the pilot? These are billion-dollar corporations. They can't afford to do it without our money, A, people would ask. B, mm-hmm. We're closing rec centers. We're talking about how tight the city money is, that we're looking at taxes that won't be paid immediately. What can we really afford to do that? And others would argue, just like the hotel downtown with the Hyatt, why shouldn't this be more of a partnership? If the city's going to, in lieu of taxes, and put up this money, in essence, put it up because we're not going to get it, should we not profit in the profit of those projects for the city? If they're going to get all these breaks, are there other ways to do it so the city actually gets more than just giving them pilots and tips while we're worrying about tips while we're worrying about how to keep rec centers open and firehouses open?
So a couple of things. Number one, made no recommendation to close firehouses. Number two, with respect to the rec centers, I am hopeful. As we move forward with a community-driven plan to increase opportunities for quality recreation, that people understand that this is about bringing the top quality that we can. When I took people around the city in the community, community stakeholders, they were appalled at some of the conditions that we have in our rec centers and the thought that we should be fighting to keep these, you know, in some cases unsafe, unclean, understaffed centers open, I think is a disservice to young people. You know, what I did is take a real look at recreation centers, take a real look at programming, and ask the community stakeholders to help me form the new generation of recreation centers. And that's what we're doing. So you want to talk about closing rec centers, which I haven't done. I'm talking about building new recreation centers, community centers that are bigger, better hours, better staff, with programming that people actually want to come to. We've already broken ground on two of those new and improved centers, and we have more on the way. We're working to use the resources that we have to enhance programming, so we're creating things, and we're creating the hours that people want to use. We're creating opportunities and programming that people actually want to use because we went to our community stakeholders to develop this plan. So, you know, I wish that you would go to the centers.
I've
and
been
see.
To centers.
So how many centers have you been to?
Over the last couple of years, I can't even count the numbers, but lots. I mean, it was traveling.
So
the city
have
all
you
time.
Ever been to a center that you feel the conditions are such that they should not, it should not be open to young people?
Yeah, there are probably a number of centers who I think that are pretty in bad shape. In
so
the
so
a lot
what
of
do
schools,
you want me
I
to
think.
Do about it?
A lot of schools
do
are
you
in
want
bad
me to
shape.
Do nothing about it? Do you want no, me to just keep them all open just for the heck of it? Or do you want me to create a recreation center system that we can be proud of? Because if you want to do that, you have to make tough choices and you have to make decisions about where you're going to invest your resources. And that's what we're doing based on a community-led plan.
So, right. the issue is in the first round of proposals to take over community centers, I mean, it was a pretty dismal round. People didn't, right? Am I correct about that?
I certainly wanted to be better, but we were doing creative things. We are looking for ways, you know, you say you want to keep recreation centers. We're looking for ways to do that. So just like we have charter schools, we're trying something new, working with partners that want, just like I said before, and I say over and over again, this is the new normal. We can't do everything by ourselves. We need to create these public-private partnerships that you just talked about and use them in different ways. And looking for a way to do that with recreation centers is something I tried. Are we going to have stumbles along the way when we try to do something innovative and new to try to keep resources available? Of course we will. But what do? We retool, we refine, and go back out again. And we're finding more partners that want to help us keep these resources in the community every time we go back out.
Now we have about a half an hour left together. We have a lot of people calling in. I do want to finish that one thought I had before we go on to the next question. But let's go take a break, mm-hmm. and we'll come right back with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. I'm going to remind you before we jump back into the conversation that WEAA, our station, can I say our own call letters? WEAA invites you to the opening reception of Sam Wallace, Jamaican Folk Art Pottery and Modern Technique. This Saturday, April 28th, from 4 to 6 p.m., right here at our WEAA studios. There will be gallery talk at 5 p.m. Beverly Carter and Lewis Hudnell are the curators. The exhibition runs through the end of May. For more information, 443-885-3564 or go to weaa.org, sponsored in part by DMV REI United. 410-319-8888.
I really think Morgan is an untapped, I shouldn't say untapped, but certainly underrated art resource. I had a great meeting with the new curator for the museum here, and I was so incredibly impressed and offered all the help I could in connecting her with the art community here, because when you take a look at the art collections that Morgan has, I mean, my hope is, just like with this show that you're hosting here, that more people will take a look at the shows that Morgan's museum has going on. It's the Lewis Museum, correct?
Right.
Because it's beautiful. I've had a chance to take a look at the collection.
Your father's alma mater.
Yeah, my father and my mother, if it were not for Morgan, I would not be here. I am what you call a true product of Morgan.
So very quick, we got to get to the phones here. What you didn't answer, though, was the question I asked about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why are we not asking more? If we're going to give something away, why isn't the city profiting from literally being a partner? We give away stadiums, get a little out of it. Why should we give this away and get out of it? Why are we not in profit sharing with these companies? We're going to give them money. If we're going to give them in lieu of taxes. And how do we know they don't have the money to take care of this themselves? These are billion-dollar corporations.
So I think we do, in some of the deals, we do do some profit sharing. I think you're right. We should look for how we get the best out of the deal for the city. And that's what we look for. We're not looking to give away the shop. We're looking to create partnerships so we can get the development that we want, quality development, as well as, you know, benefit the city in the long run.
Let's go to the phones here. 410-319-8888. And who has been? Hank, you've been hanging on a long time. You're on the air. On line two, Hank, still with us? Let us then go to, is it Adam? You've been hanging on a while. Adam, you're on the air.
Good evening, Mark and Madam Mayor.
Welcome.
Good evening.
Mayor, I actually had a question about criminal justice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Michelle Alexander's new book, The New Jim Crow, in response to some of the high incarceration rates of black Americans in the United States, she calls it the civil rights issue of our time. So the question I have is, one, do you agree with that characterization? And two, as mayor of Baltimore, what are some of the things that you think you can do to kind of change that trend of high incarceration of black Americans?
Good question.
It is something that is very disappointing. And I actually had a very good conversation with Mayor Bloomberg last week about strategies around reducing the number of individuals that are incarcerated while still reducing crime. And that's one of the things that I'm proud about in my administration. We were able to get the homicide rate down to the lowest it's been since 1977, all the while reducing the number of arrests that we've made. And I think that if you focus your resources on the most violent offenders, as we have, you can do that. You can focus your attention on the individuals who need to be caught in the net and without casting that wide net that causes far too many of our particularly young men to be involved in the criminal justice system. So, I mean, that's what I fight for in my administration. So you asked about the characterization. I would need to know more. I'm familiar with the author, but not the whole characterization. But it is something that concerns me, and that's why we have focused public safety strategy.
Especially against the new Jim Crow, that what we're doing is locking up millions of black men in this country, most of them should not be in prison.
No, I get it. I get it. And that's why we have a focused strategy. You know, I certainly know that, not every city is like this. Unfortunately, but I know that in New York they have the focused strategy, so they're reducing their incarcerated population. We're reducing our number of arrests. You know, we get it, and we're certainly working towards, focusing on the individuals that are causing harm to themselves and to the community and really need to be off the street.
Tara Lynn from Morgan, you're on the air.
Hi, Hi. Mayor Rawlings Blake. I wanted to definitely chime in on the partnership piece as far as our program, which is housed on Morgan State's campus, which is the Educational Talent Search Program, which is a federally funded program through TRIO and Department of Education. And we are offering free summer programs to the students of the Northeast Baltimore area this summer. So if students need an outlet that is educationally based so that they get the preparation in order to work, so that they are well-informed contributors to the workforce of Baltimore City, we are definitely able to take them and to fulfill the role that's necessary in order to prepare them for the workforce.
Would it be possible if you could hold the line so I could get your contact information? We're putting together in the website the program that Super Summer that I talked about. We're trying to give as much information as we can about all the quality summer programs that we have, and I would love to make sure that we're able to talk about yours as well. I don't know if that's possible, Mark, if you could hold on and get her contact information. Yes, they're telling me they can do it, because I would love to be able to talk about that resource with people from all over the city.
Rebecca writes in, what specifically in the proposed new zoning code for Baltimore City will make it easier for new urban farmers to acquire and begin farming on vacant city lots? Can the city expect a simplified zoning code to correlate directly with an increase in urban farms in food deserts?
Not just in food deserts, but all over the city. You know, Baltimore City was the first city in the country to hire a food policy director, Holly Freistein. It's fantastic. We just had a meeting with Mayor Menino. I'm the vice chair of the U.S. Conference of Mayors Food Policy Task Force, and the urban farming is one of the things that we talked about. We visited urban agriculture in Boston, and we talked about the different programs that we have here. You know, we've been aggressive. We've identified 20 acres of farmable land. We've put out RFPs. We have training programs for people that are interested in urban agriculture. And as we take a look at the zoning code, we're certainly looking for ways to make it easier for urban agriculture to take place, because I believe very strongly in what we are borrowing from Minneapolis, which is home. They have homegrown Minneapolis. We have homegrown Baltimore. We want to grow local, buy local, eat local. And by making it easier and developing these partnerships with farmers, I think we can get there.
When do we think the first farms will be online? Those RFPs will be done. They've been out a while. When are we going to see kind of hoe in the ground, so to speak?
Well, we do have some that are up and running. I don't know if directly from the RFP, but we do have urban farmers, all over the city. I can get that information back to you about when the first farms will be up and running from the RFP.
A question here from Megan. Where did I put it? I have it right here someplace. I'll get to that.
Talk about food deserts?
You can. Go ahead.
So one of the other things that we're working on is promoting our virtual supermarket. We've got a partnership with the Enoch Pratt Free Library, where we have in a couple of food deserts. We have that resource where, in partnership with San Antonio's, People can either go online or go into the library online and order their foods and then come back the next day and get those groceries. It's a great program. It is a groundbreaking program as far as what we're able to do for online purchasing, because we accept the EBT cards in the program. And we've already been recognized nationally for this model. So we have Enoch Proffitt Libraries. We have at least one school on board. Department of Social Services is on board. And now we're going to be locating in some senior centers as well. I'm certainly committed to bringing giving access to fresh fruits and vegetables to communities all over the city. And we have to do creative things to get there. So I'm really proud of the work that we're doing. And have you had Holly on your show?
Many times.
Yeah. So she's great, and we're working very hard. In my goal to make Baltimore one of the healthiest cities in the country, access to healthy food is essential. And we're working very hard as a component of my Healthy Baltimore 2015.
Let us go to Melissa here on the air.
Hi, Mayor Rawlings-Blake. My quick question for you is in regards to extra work orders. I've been following the Board of Estimates for some time now, and I think in budgeting it's easy to look at pilots and TIFs and really see a large outflow of money, but it is really the dribs and drabs over many years that I think do the most harm to budgets. And when we have extra work orders that exceed 100% of the initial bid price, I really, as a citizen of the city, am skeptical that all of those extra work orders are needed. I'm not speaking of things like Herring Run Parkway, where there is a true emergency in sewer and EPA issues, but where we're seeing the 60th or 70th extra work order for a budgeting issue in the city that could be planned for. And so I wanted to know, would you support a bond effort or auditing to figure out why this is occurring and why this is consuming a greater share of our city's resources? Thank you.
So I've had concerns about extra work orders since I first convened the Board of Estimates as president of the city council. That's something that concerned me, and that's why we do audit. We track who's putting in the extra work orders, how much over the original estimate is, are these, work orders amounting to. It can be a problem, and abuse, if we're not tracking it, can happen. So, while we certainly don't want extra work orders, there's a process. You don't just put a work order in and get paid extra work order. It has to be verified, and we also balance it against, what you said that you were going to be able to do the work for, and see if you have a history of, what we'd say are questionable work orders.
410-319-8888. I promise I get this over to our listeners. I have more questions I want to throw in, but I'm going to get you out here.
Mm-hmm.
Both Michael Redding and Adam Kowalski write in. Basically the same thing. I'll read one of the quotes here. How about you fix the potholes tearing up our cars in residential areas before you go preparing streets for the Grand Prix? You even cut down your own trees for them. What do we get? And so, two things here, I think. One is, some people say the money would have been better spent on fixing the potholes in the city, which are terrible. Destroyed my car, cost me almost $800 after I hit a city pothole.
So can we just talk about the street paving? So the money that was spent for street paving downtown is federal money that can only be spent on those major thoroughfares. So while we would like to be able to go through and use that money to fill up potholes, it was specially designated money used for that purpose. And because we used it for that purpose, we got an opportunity to make over $47 million in economic activity. That being said, we're on pace to pave record numbers of neighborhood streets. We have an aggressive street paving. We've invested in one machine that is incredible. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I've actually ridden on it. That makes quick work of paving the streets. We're bringing it in-house, so we're doing it for cheaper than we were when we were contracting it out. We're doing it cheaper, we're doing it faster, and we're being able to do more lane miles because of it.
So, what about the Grand Prix? Are we going to do it this year? People are saying that maybe even the Sun has talked about, in this fairly conservative paper, that we should stop. We should not do it this year, that it makes no sense. We can't seem to get the two people running it. I was kind of shocked to learn, actually worked for Enron when the scandal broke, that they've fallen out with the man who was brought in to make it work. They've yet to find somebody to run it. that the city, if we're on scale doing the same kind of people here last year, numbers of people, we won't even half meet what we invested in last time, that this time may put it off a year. This is maybe not working. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm concerned, but I'm hopeful. Discussions with IndyCar are ongoing. At this point, we're keeping an open mind, and we're willing to consider reasonable options. You know, as I mentioned before, last year we had an opportunity to showcase our city in a wonderful, wonderful way on a grand world stage, creating more than $47 million in economic activity. The racers there thought it was the best race of the season. The sponsors said the same thing. The Indy race officials thought that the Baltimore race was incredible, just in general, but not let alone for an inaugural race. So they have a lot of interest in making sure that Baltimore is successful. They tie the success of this race to the success of their industry and their company. So they have an interest in making sure that it's successful. And because of that, they have been working very hard. And as I mentioned before, we're keeping an open mind.
Now, there are most restaurateurs we've talked to in South Baltimore literally complained bitterly about this race because the race was allowed to bring their own food. Nobody ate in the restaurants in Baltimore. Nobody went to the Lidley. Nobody went to South Baltimore. The places were vacant. And I think that was true. I mean, I no reason why those restaurateurs would lie about this. Should that Grand Prix, if they do come back, be forced not to bring their food so that people eat in Baltimore rather than bring their own food?
Yes, and hopefully this time the media won't scare the heck out of people into coming downtown so they can actually come down. You could have crawled down 83 during Grand Prix weekend, but the media
scared
the heck.
Well, it's like being in New Orleans doing the Mardi Gras. You don't want to go to New Orleans. Don't go to the Mardi Gras. They stay away from it because too many tourists come in, so you don't go down.
You could have zigzag crawled down 83 during that weekend because so many people were scared. The media scared the heck out of people. Don't go downtown. It's going to be such a mess. And you could have gone in and out of Little Italy 10 times and had a time.
Well, so
you want to blame the Grand Prix. Take some responsibility. You all sat there
and talked about how bad
it was going to be and then said, oh, my God, and nobody came.
No, they didn't
come because everybody scared them away. So that being said, I'm talking about
the 100,000 people who came to Baltimore didn't go to Baltimore. They just went there and never went out.
That's not true. They didn't make it over to Little Italy, but they made it to several places, and the hope is to grow it. It was an inaugural race, and in an inaugural race, you learn, and you have opportunities to grow. So that's what we're doing.
Let's go back to the phones, 410-319-8888. And let's see. People have been waiting a long time. Sarhan, you're on the air.
Sarhan?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Mayor, I thank you for giving me the opportunity. I'd like to bring your attention back to the issue of gambling, table gamblings, and rehash this issue with you, specifically to go back to your argument as far as other states who are fully taking advantage of Marylanders who gamble at their casinos. Unfortunately, and with all due respect, I would like to point out an inherent flaw in your argument where you fail to take into account the additional gamblers that you would be adding by opening casinos or a casino in Baltimore City and the additional social cost associated, especially with exposing our communities, some of our most fragile segments of our community to the, I don't want to say ills because that might, show a bias, but research shows that most gamblers tend to come from lower income families where they typically tend to have less discretionary income. You can look at this data. Now, I understand that you as a mayor are trying your best to bring in a diverse source of income. And in that regards, I would like to suggest that you ditch the idea of table games and instead focus on other innovative ideas, which, for instance, do you know how many people who work in Baltimore City don't actually live in Baltimore City? I'm sure you're aware of this. I'm sorry if I'm stating the obvious. Why not pass a limited mandate that gradually over time, mandates employers of Baltimore City to start hiring more folks from within the city?
Okay, sorry. Let me
So I'll back up. So a couple of things. Number one, we already have that. I signed an executive order and actually put some teeth into the Hire Baltimore initiative. So people that are doing business with Baltimore, I think the threshold is $25,000 or $50,000 before they hire anyone new to the job. They have to make those job postings with us so we can get the word out to city residents through the Mayor's Office of Employment Development. And if they don't meet the requirements of the executive order, they won't get paid. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, while I understand and appreciate his argument, the voters didn't agree with him. This issue was taken to the poll, to the people, and the people overwhelmingly voted for slots. And in my efforts to, fight for the table games, I'm fighting for the opportunity for the voters of the city and the state to have that same right to voice their opinion, to say what how they want the city and the state to get revenue.
So Megan writes in, how much money is being allocated to fund schools? How much is being allocated for policing? If crime has decreased in the city, why do we continue to give money to the police every year and not put more money in schools?
We're increasing funds for school, I think, every year. And the reason why you continue to fund the police department is so they can continue to do their job. You know, I'm proud of the fact that we reduced the homicide rate to the lowest since 1977, but we're still a city that has too many homicides. So what, now that the police have done a good job, you take the money away? No, you continue to work on the strategies that have allowed us to create safer neighborhoods, and we work to create those safer to tackle those issues in areas where the feeling of safety hasn't caught up with the fact that we're reducing the homicide numbers. We have to do better, and you don't do better by cutting back on the resources. You continue to invest to make sure that we can keep officers on the street and give them the equipment that they need and invest in the technology that helps them to be more efficient.
Now, I know you can't comment on a case that everybody's talking about, the Wittersheim case. I'm not going to ask you to comment on what's going on in that case. However, I will ask you these two quick questions about that.
Mm-hmm.
A, should the mayor's office be more involved in dealing with the serious divide between the Orthodox Jewish community and the black community in Northwest Baltimore? Because there's a huge divide, which is at the bottom of this, A and B. Should Shomrim or any other group in the city have an ethnically, quote-unquote, pure group that patrols a community in the community that is mixed, that if there's going to be a patrol, should that patrol be made up of African-Americans, Jewish-Americans, Caribbean-Americans, all Latino-Americans, all those who make up that community? So
I'm very proud that Baltimore has 55 citizens on patrol groups. Many of them are extremely active. And there is no prohibition in that area from a Jamaican American, African American, or anyone else creating citizens on patrol groups. Each organization works closely with the police department. That's what we ask them to do. We do not define the qualifications for membership or participation in the different patrol groups. Anybody that wants to help us, to do their part. To step up and to help keep our streets safe, we want to work with them.
But that's not. But what I'm saying is, there's this huge divide in that community between black and especially Orthodox Jewish communities. Shouldn't we be saying to mitigate that? Maybe the idea of having separate groups is not the smartest thing for us to do.
Yeah, I think we've come a long way. Certainly, we have more work to do in that community. I think, the thing that concerns me is that people that don't live in the community are imposing their notions of what should and shouldn't happen. And it's not, I take my direction from, the community members there. And, when this incident happened, as unfortunate as it was, I felt that, number one, Shomrim immediately, severed ties with these guys and went to the diverse community to try to make sure something like this never happens again. So, while the community tries to heal, the people from the outside are trying to create, create deeper schisms.
All right. We almost out of time. We can't push that. We have time for one quick call? Very quick. Meredith, you're on the air. We don't have much time. Go ahead.
Good evening, all. Good evening. I wanted to ask the mayor, good evening, Yana. I wanted to ask the mayor regarding mental health care for young people. Oftentimes, young people end up in juvenile justice system because they do lack appropriate mental health care, particularly a lot of kids in Baltimore suffering from PTSD, ADHD, and things of that nature. So how does your administration address mental health care for juveniles, and what are some ways the community can get involved in helping our young people overcome mental illness?
So thank you for bringing that up. Unfortunately, you know, getting help for mental illness carries such a stigma, particularly in the African-American community. And I worked for years in Baltimore City's mental health court and understood, you know, the toll that is taken on families and communities when people go without adequate treatment. So you talked about young people, and that's why I fought to make sure that the funds for school health care workers remained in the budget. And we had to do, you know, we had to increase fees and things like that and taxes to make it all work. But we didn't want those resources not to be there, because those are the ones who are on the front lines and sometimes can identify young people that need to be in treatment, and also have the wherewithal to identify treatment slots or treatment access to treatment for those young people. So that is those are some of the things that we're doing.
Well, Mayor Stephen Rawlings Blake, we have like 30 seconds and at least 10 emails, 10 callers, 10 Facebook questions. You couldn't stay there a couple hours, could you? I guess not.
You know, it's Blue Mass this evening. It's a community-wide event, service of prayer for our public safety workers. So I feel compelled to, you know, pray for and, you know, and to thank our men and women who serve in public safety capacities. And it's an annual event right down the street, and I'm looking forward to being there.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake has been our guest. Thank you all for calling in and writing in, and we're about to have a conversation with Congressman Donna Edwards, and then move on to other issues facing us all. Stay with us. We'll be right back.